Okay, good afternoon. Yeah. Okay, I don't know whether it makes any difference, but yeah, better. That'll wake up the people in the back, this being an early talk. blackboard talk on complex multiplication. And if you've seen the formulas presented by Pierrick, you know that that's a restriction. So there are certain formulas I will not write down, as will become clear later on. I didn't want to assume that everybody here was expert in or even interested in complex multiplication, and this being 9 a.m., I thought it would be good to give some kind of introduction to complex multiplication, formulate the challenges, of course that's the workshop title, sort of on the go, and hopefully in the end ask questions about genus 2 rather than presenting solutions. So I'll only stick to low genus. Genus 2 is as far as we will get, and I thought it might be a good idea to illustrate complex multiplication in the case where nobody calls it complex multiplication, which is the genus zero case, which is maybe so degenerate that it isn't even worth considering, but I'll still sort of say something about it, since many of the features we will see during the rest of the talk are already visible in the genus zero case, since complex multiplication is a theory that sort of relates complex analytic methods to algebraic methods. So on the complex analytic side, we will have Riemann surfaces, complex tori. On the algebraic side, you get algebraic curves and varieties. And that's something you can already do in genus zero. So let me warm up, given the temperature, maybe a good idea. Genus zero, there won't be too many challenges, but I will come to the challenges in genus one and present some solutions or partial solutions to those challenges. And then in genus 2, we will just have challenges that are even harder and that are still waiting for the ultimate answer. So a genus 0 curve is easy to write down, but to sort of stay in line with what's going to happen the rest of the talk, genus being at most 2, every curve will be hyperelliptic. So I will write down my genus 0 curve. So this is the algebraic side where we're going to find the curves. The curve is going to look like y square equals something, and the something to make it genus zero has to be of degree at most 2. And I will normalize it in my favorite way by, this is the curve C, y square equals 1 minus x square. That's the genus zero curve, and you may recognize it. It's the unit circle, so the corresponding pictures, here's the picture of my curve over the real numbers. But as I promised, I will use complex numbers, so the aim is now to parameterize this curve using the complex numbers. So that means that we're going to parameterize the points on that curve using complex analytic functions. And being the unit circle, you know what to expect. This is sort of the high school version of complex multiplication. You get the sine and the cosine. So we can map z to the point sine z, cosine z, which will end up on a unit circle. And as you know, sine and cosine are periodic functions, so this is in fact a map on the complex numbers, which is periodic with period 2 pi. So in fact it factors, so here's the map, on CMOD multiples of 2 pi, 2 pi z. So the picture on the left-hand side, here is a Riemann surface, it's a quotient of the complex plane, it looks like a cylinder, so I guess the picture has to be something like this. Here's the cylinder at CMOD 2 pi z, and the image is the, well, over the reals it looks like the unit circle. If you do it over the complex numbers, then you know the, need to know the complex sine and cosine. It just means that rather than having absolute value 1, the absolute value can be anything between 0, anything positive. So the corresponding picture probably looks like this. Here's the real locus, that's the unit circle, and then you can sort of extend it both ways all the way up to infinity, and here it looks really a bit like a Riemann sphere. This is a sphere which is missing 2 points. Okay, so what's the use of this sort of silly picture? As you see, C is just an algebraic curve, it's an affine curve, so this is in fact, it's in C2. And in fact this map, as is easy to check if you know about sines and cosines, is an isomorphism, so that means that on the left-hand side, you're having a Riemann surface which has a group structure, since it's a quotient of the additive group of the complex numbers, which means that this funny algebraic curve on the right, this unit circle of the complex numbers, also has an algebraic structure. And, well, the group law is the is given by the high school formulas for sines and cosines. If you want to add a point, sine z1, cosine z1, to a point, sine z2, cosine z2. Then you get, well, just if you copy the addition from the left, it means you need to get the sine of z1 plus z2 and the cosine of z1 plus z2. And if you've been to high school, which I assume, then you know that these sines of and cosines of sums of angles can be expressed by polynomial formulas in the sines and cosines of z1 and z2. So you see that what you get is an algebraic group, meaning that the addition formula on the curve is given by, in this case, polynomial formulas, reflecting what you knew already from high school, but then they didn't tell you maybe that it came from the complex exponential. What's a little bit weird here, which is something you don't get in higher genus, is that this curve, or this Riemann surface here, is not a compact one. As you see, it has two holes. There is a point missing, I times infinity, and there is negative I times infinity. These are the two points lacking. If you want, you can complete the whole thing to get the true Riemann sphere. So you have to give this a complex structure that's done in the standard way. If you put Q equal to, as most people do, e to the 2 pi iz, then this becomes the point Q equals 0. And here you have the point 1 over Q equals 0. If you complete it in that way, then on the left you get a Riemann sphere. On the right, that corresponds to completing this curve to a projective curve. So the complete curve in the projective plane over the complex numbers has equation, standard equation x squared plus y squared equals z squared. So the two points that are missing that you didn't see in the real picture are the points 1, I, 0, this one, and there's one at the bottom, 1, negative I, 0. So it's just a Riemann sphere minus two points. And of course, my whole algebraic group here is a thinly disguised version of the multiplicative group. But still, it has several of the essential features. So what are the things we will be interested in the higher genus cases? So what's the relation with challenging problems in the end? Here the non-challenging problem is that already something comes out. This algebraic group yields what you might call explicit classical theory over the rationals. Over Q. Since you see this curve, this unit circle is in fact a curve which happens to be defined over the rationals, even though we started out with complex numbers, transcendental functions, you get something fairly simple, and you can use it over the rational numbers using this group. You can look at the n-torsion points. So if you take the curve and you look at the n-torsion points over the complex numbers, well, you can, for instance, read it off by going to the left. You see that in C mod 2 pi z, you look at the n-torsion points, so this looks like 1 over n, 2 pi z, over 2 pi z. So it's a cyclic group of order n. And if you look at the coordinates, you get certain points. It's the group which is generated by the points cosine, maybe sine in my order, 2 pi over n, cosine 2 pi over n. That'll generate a group which is cyclic of order n. And if you adjoin the coordinates of these points, you get a familiar extension over the rationals. It's a cyclotomic extension. So if you write, so adjoin the n-torsion points, what you get is the cyclotomic field. Oops. You get the field that's usually denoted by Q zeta n. So zeta n is a primitive nth root of unity. And we also get a Galois action. The Galois action on Q zeta n over Q, that's an action on these torsion points that generate the extension. And as everybody knows, the corresponding group Z mod n Z star, which is just raising the root of unity to a power, on the left-hand side corresponds to multiplication in C by, in this case, integers. So the complex multiplication is fairly simple. It's just multiplication by integers. So the Galois action is given on the analytic side by multiplication by integers. So if you want, this is an example of non-complex multiplication. What does it yield from an algorithmic point of view? It's not so interesting, but if you want to generate Hebbian extensions over the rationals, first of all, there is a theorem that tells you, let me write it down here. There's the Kronecker-Weber theorem, which tells you that this procedure, I mean adjoining these nth torsion points, this procedure yields all abelian extensions of the rationals, extensions over Q, meaning that every finite abelian extension of the rationals can be embedded in a cyclotomic extension. So that means that there is the algorithmic problem. Can you actually write down minimum polynomials for the generators? And that's the familiar problem of computing cyclotomic polynomials. And this non-complex multiplication provides a way by analytic means, since you can actually compute these nth roots of unity as complex numbers using sines and cosines, multiply them together, so you have all the conjugates, and then you get a polynomial which in principle lies in Cx. It has complex coordinates, but this being something algebraic, you know that in the end the coefficients will in fact be rational and integral, so the thing is in Zx. So you can compute cyclotomic polynomials analytically. I'm not saying that this is particularly interesting, since there's also an algebraic alternative. Which is what most people use, or might use, to find cyclotomic polynomials. If you just factor x to the n minus 1, you find all the cyclotomic polynomials, phi d, with d dividing n. So if you want, you don't need this analytic approach at all. Another important feature is that in this algebraic setting that you have on the right-hand side, you can reduce modulo primes, in this case, of the rationals. So this algebraic group has a reduction mod p. So another silly feature is that this algebraic group C can be reduced mod P to give an algebraic group over the finite field of P elements. And if you think about it for a second, you'll see that you can count the number of points fairly easily. It's either P minus 1 or P plus 1, depending on whether your prime is 1 mod 4 or 3 mod 4. So there isn't much to say here. In fact, you know what the group is. In the first case, you have an FP star. In the second case, you have a kernel of a norm from FP square to star to FP star. Okay, that's genus zero, so that's basically the trivial case, but you see several of the features we will encounter later on in the more interesting case where the genus becomes one. So let's try and do the same thing for, in this case, elliptic curves. So again, we need to write down something on the algebraic side. So we start out again by writing y square equals something. And the something to give a genus 1 has to have degree 3 or 4. So now you can normalize your curve in various ways. You can take degree 4, as Jacobi did, or take the cubic example. And then even there's more that's competing. You can either go for the Legendre model, this one, or the Weierstrass model, which historically looks like this. And try and parameterize this, in this case, elliptic curve again by analytic functions. And that's the version which hasn't made it into high school yet, probably will soon, given the importance of elliptic curves, even though it may not be in crypto. They will be, of course, in hash functions later on, as we believe Johannes Buchmann, but this is still to happen. So better be prepared, know about elliptic curves. And as you see, again, we want to make a map from the complex numbers, so you need to find functions that parameterize the elliptic curve. And of course, the exact form will depend on which model you choose. So let me go for the Weierstrass, the standard model. So W will map it to this curve. And as you know, what you get is the Weierstrass P function. So you get sort of this genus 1 sine and cosine, and you need to map Z to PZ, P prime Z. And right here you see already that even though in the genus zero case it was sort of wise to stick to the analytic, sort of to the affine part to get a nice group, here you need to go for the projective curve right away in order to be able to define your Weierstrass. So in this curve has to be viewed as a projective curve over the complex numbers. So I just write down the affine equation. And the reason you need this is that this Weierstrass P function will have poles, so there is the zero, which will go to the projective point 0, 1, 0. So here's the definition. And the Weierstrass P function, as you know, in fact, has two periods. The sine and the cosine have a single period, 2 pi. Here you get a second one, and that means that the thing will factor via C modulo a lattice. So it has two independent periods. If you want to compute those periods, in fact, that's something I didn't do here since I assumed you knew that already for the sine and cosine, that they were periodic. You can do so. If you want to do that, you note that this map has a function as a derivative, so there is a holomorphic differential, which is dx over y. Let me call it omega. That's a holomorphic differential on this affine curve. And if you integrate it on the path here, since you want to know how wide the cylinder is, so to speak, so that means you have to take dz, which becomes omega here, and integrate it along gamma to see what you get here. And indeed, if you do so, you need to integrate, well, dx over y is this integral, since x is 1 minus, yeah. And you have to integrate it, well, twice back and forth between negative 1 and 1, and twice this integral does indeed give you the 2 pi back. People who are a little bit annoyed by the holomorphic differential in genus 0 should realize that this is an affine curve, and in fact this omega has poles at the missing points with residue I and negative I. So if you didn't know about this integral from your calculus courses, you can also apply the residue theorem and just you go around the residue, and the residue being I, you get the 2 pi as well. Whatever you like. And that's exactly what happens here. In the same way, there's also a dx over y, the holomorphic differential, for the same reason that you can integrate. The curve in this case looks a bit different. It's a torus, as you know, so there you go. And the other picture that I forgot to draw, but that everybody knows already, is this one, the elliptic curve. And you can compute the lattice from the curve by integrating the holomorphic differential coming from the dz here on the left-hand side over a basis for the homology of your elliptic curve. So here is the Weierstrass parametrization. And exactly the same thing happens. On the left-hand side, there is a group, so that can be transferred to the right-hand side. And the conclusion is that this elliptic curve has an algebraic group structure. There's a group addition that you can describe by explicit formulas that are not as well known as they are for sines and cosines, but are still sort of familiar and that can be found in many books. Another difference is that there basically here is a unique curve. So here is a unique example, which is just P1, at least unique example. It's a single curve up to isomorphism over the complex numbers, and it's just the P1. Here you see that you have a one-parameter family. You can see it from the Legendre model, for instance. It depends on lambda, and basically lambda gives you the isomorphic class, isomorphism type. So here you have a one-parameter family. And if you want to make that a little bit more precise, then you should see how the elliptic curve depends on the parameters. You can do it on both sides. Here you can say that, well, you may scale your lambda so that it's generated by 1 and something tau, which is traditionally chosen in the upper half plane. Then it will depend on tau on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, it will depend on G2, G3 in the Weierstrass model or on lambda in the Legendre model. And if you want to have a parameter that describes the isomorphism class, then you notice that on the left-hand side, this tau in the upper half-plane, the isomorphism class of lambda under complex multiplications is not determined by tau itself, but you have to take tau in the upper half-plane up to the action of SL2z. And if you do that, you get a P1. So tau gets mapped to J of tau. And on the algebraic side, this J invariant can be described both in terms of G2 and G3. So this is the same thing as the J of the elliptic curve. I don't think it has a name already, so it's now called E, which can be described by familiar formulas. And I hope these are the formulas, and if they aren't these, then they're very similar. And in terms of lambda, it's something of degree 6, so lambda, it's sort of a 6-to-1 map. Might be this. At any rate, you see that from the curve there's this invariant, and it's really a one parameter family over complex numbers. This quantity on either side describes the isomorphism type of your elliptic curve as a complex Riemann surface. And also something which is important, which we don't have immediately in genus 2, is that writing down an elliptic curve is roughly equivalent to writing down its J invariant. Yeah, since it's easy to write down, given J, an elliptic curve having J invariant J. So elliptic curves, so writing down E, you can think of as roughly the same thing as writing down its J invariant. Okay, so the moduli space here is just a P1. So what happens to the explicit class field theory that we had over the rationals? Here it gets replaced by explicit class field theory over imaginary quadratic fields. So usually these lattices, they only have multiplications by integers, just like in the genus 0 case, but sometimes there's more, and then you have truly complex multiplications, and that's where the CM theory starts. If you have lattices having more multipliers than only integers, complex multiplications, then they look like lattices that are, up to scaling, ideals for imaginary quadratic orders. So the basic case you could think of is you take your lambda equal to the ring of integers with k imaginary quadratic, discriminant D, then this J invariant in fact becomes an algebraic number, so you get explicit class field theory sort of in two steps over this imaginary quadratic field D, namely this J invariant of the elliptic curve described by C modulo the ring of integers is an algebraic integer, so G of OK is an algebraic integer. And if you adjoin it to K, you get its Hilbert class field. So K adjoin G of OK, this lattice, is H, the Hilbert class field, of K, which is by definition the maximal unramified extension of the field K. This being an algebraic number, it has an irreducible polynomial that you can write down explicitly again. And the 19th century formula that gives you this irreducible polynomial, maybe you should write it down here, is called the class polynomial P of D. So for any imaginary quadratic discriminant D, there is a corresponding polynomial. The irreducible polynomial is a J invariant of its ring of integers. And you find it by taking as the roots the J invariants of the lattices that come from the class group. So you take all ideal classes in this ring of integers, K being embedded in the complex numbers, these ideals are naturally lattices. They have a J invariant from this setting. And in the end, you find a polynomial, which in principle has complex coefficients. But again, this theorem, it's an algebraic integer, so you know that, in fact, these coefficients end up being integers. So it means that you can now compute the polynomial by analytic means by approximating J invariants. So you need an explicit definition of J in terms of complex numbers. You can calculate the roots with a certain precision, and if you do so, you can find this polynomial round the coefficients and find a polynomial having integral coefficients. So this is the class polynomial, which you can compute by analytic means. There is also an algebraic alternative, just like in the rational case, but that's very unattractive. The algebraic alternative, algebraically, you can also do this, but I don't think anybody does, since then you need to take modular polynomials that are known to be very large. So if you take phi n, there's a clash of notation. This phi n is now the modular polynomial of level n, modular polynomial. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. It's a two-variable thing. You make it one variable like this, and if you factor it you get class polynomials PD to certain exponents, just like in the gene zero case, and this exponent ED basically is the number of elements of norm N in the order of discriminant D. So I won't go into it, since it's algorithmically an uninteresting formula. This polynomial is way too big to compute these polynomials in this way, in an efficient way. So the algebraic alternative is something you don't use, and it means that this is one of the standard ways to compute class polynomials. There's a problem, of course, that you need certain precision. If you don't like it, you can also do it p-adically. That's more recent. That's something I won't go into very much today. Okay, so here's the class polynomial that will give you the Hilbert class field. And in fact, there is a similar theorem, like the Kronecker-Weber theorem. If you go a little bit further, this is the Hilbert class field that only gives you the unramified extension, maximal abelian unramified extension. You can get them all. So that's the main theorem of one of the versions of the main theorem of complex multiplication. You write it down here, theorem. If you take this elliptic curve corresponding to the ring of integers of this imaginary quadratic field K, and you write down a model which is defined, well, the smallest field you can define it over is this Hilbert class field, since you need to have the J invariant which generates this field already. So if you take E of K, a model of C modulo OK, over the Hilbert class field, then you can get all the abelian extensions of the field K by adjoining x coordinates of torsion points. So if you take this elliptic curve and you look at its end torsion, so you take EK over the complex numbers, then as a group, you know what you get. You get 1n lambda, or lambda is OK here, sorry. So it's a group which is a product of two cyclic groups of order n. And if you adjoin these, the coordinates, the x coordinates, so by adjoining the x coordinates, so these are the elements on the Kummer line, as they're now called, I think. If you adjoin them to K, or to H, maybe I should say, x coordinates of n torsion points to A, you obtain HN, which is the N ray class field, N ray class field of K. And the equivalent of the Kronecker-Weber theorem here is that any abelian extension over K is a subfield of a certain ray class field for a given N. So the Kronecker-Weber, well, in this case, it says that every abelian L over K finite is gotten in this way as a subfield of some HN. And you also get the explicit Galois action, since it comes again from the complex multiplication, the Galois group of HN over H. Is gotten by multiplications by integers in OK co-prime to N, and the group you get is OK modulo N OK star. That's if you just look at the points. Since we're only taking x coordinates, we don't see plus or minus 1 anymore. So this is the group you get. The Galois action comes from multiplication by complex numbers. And if you want to be precise, you should exclude the cases where there are more roots of unity. So D should be smaller than negative 4 here. So here's the explicit class field theory again. And of course, from a computational point of view, the question is, can you actually compute these abelian extensions? So, of course, this explicit class field theory immediately leads to an algorithmic problem. Can you actually write down the corresponding polynomials? And you see that basically you do have a means to do so by analytic means. For the J invariant, there's this class polynomial, and these x coordinates, well, you can just by computing Weierstrass coordinates, you can approximate them as complex numbers, and what you get is a polynomial that you know to be algebraic, so you can round to the algebraic numbers you need. And of course the question is, how well does it work in practice? That's something else I will say more on in a moment. Something else, the analog of the thing. Oh, that got erased already. If you have these elliptic curves, you can also reduce them modulo primes, in this case of H. And that will give you elliptic curves over finite fields. And the basic case is if you take a prime, which splits in OK into principal ideals, so it's really a norm of a prime ideal, pi in OK, then you can reduce your elliptic curve EK modulo a prime lying over P in the Hilbert class field. Maybe show reduce EK modulo a prime P over P in H, since your elliptic curve was defined over H. And if you do so, then you get elliptic curve K bar modulo P. If you look at its FP rational points, you can compute it in terms of pi, you get P plus 1 plus or minus the trace of pi. And of course the plus or minus will depend on, well, pi was not uniquely defined, it was this quadratic twist business I won't go into right now. So it is a way to create elliptic curves over finite fields from characteristic zero. Basically you start out with complex numbers, you take these approximations, find the model of the elliptic curve, reduce it modulo a prime over P, and you find an elliptic curve over the finite field. And basically what you do, of course, is just writing down the corresponding J invariant over FP, rather than do all these explicit curve models. So this opens up a way to construct elliptic curves over finite fields. What are the computational challenges in this genus 1 case? So the two problems I want to focus on is explicit class field theory, so write down generating polynomials for class fields, and secondly, how efficiently can you generate given elliptic curves using this method. And the problem is, so the first problem you encounter, problem, the corresponding polynomials, so already in the case that you need for these elliptic curves, that's only the J invariant polynomial, the class polynomial, these tend to be pretty big. Polynomials, let me focus on the PD, are big. And big means two things. Asymptotically, of course, there is a degree and there is the size of the coefficients. The degree of PD is just the class number of the corresponding ring of integers of the quadratic field. So the degree is the class number of the field Q square root D, which is roughly square root of the discriminant, so it grows exponentially in D. But even worse, also the coefficients tend to be pretty big. This J function is sort of an exponential function, so that means that also the coefficients, so the size of the coefficients, number of digits of coefficients, if you estimate them, you also roughly get the square root of D. So that means that computing such a polynomial is intrinsically exponential in the input parameter D. So in a way, there is no good solution to the problem if you want it efficiently in terms of D. The output is just too big. There is a partial solution. Maybe I should say that the minimal runtime is basically O of D up to epsilon. And that's something you can really attain. Complex analytically, I think that's a paper by Andreas Enge. And also in the Piatic case, I think it occurs in Renier Broeker's thesis. You can, however, make them smaller. So there is a partial solution, which is more like a practical solution if for these that you really encounter. You don't want to write down these huge polynomials. If D is simply a two-digit thing, it may be that PD already gets 10 or 20 digits or even more. And that's very unpleasant. And that's a classical art due to Weber. It's called class invariance. And it's the method to replace the J function by smaller functions. So replace J. Weber gives many examples. You can take the cube root of J. That's called gamma 2. The favorite example of Weber was eta 2z over eta z. This is called Weber's function. If we have to normalize it with a square root. There's variance eta pz over eta z, something that François Morin has been working together with Atkins, I think, for a practical elliptic curve primality proving. And in Paris, I think, people use nowadays functions of the form eta z over p, z over q. It's double eta quotients, as they're called, eta z, z over pq. All these functions are smaller than the j function. That's clear if you look at this cube root. You will gain a factor 3 in the size of the coefficients if you go for cube roots. And for the Weber function, you even get a factor of 72, which is the champion, so to speak. You do encounter new problems since the Galois action. In this case, there is an explicit Galois action. The Galois group of H over K is the class group. I should have written that down at some stage. And the Galois action here is exactly what you think. This is a principal homogeneous space over the class group. In this case, the Galois action is more complicated to determine. First of all, in principle, these are higher level modular functions. This is a level 3 modular function rather than level 1. So it may not work in all cases. You get conditions on your discriminant D. For instance, it shouldn't be divisible by 3. This Weber function also works in special cases, and the level in this case is 48. And this is probably 24p. So these higher level functions can sometimes be used, and you have to determine when they can be used, and then if they can be used, how you compute the conjugates, so the action of the class group on appropriate values of these functions. That's a whole topic. The basic tool nowadays, I think, is due to Shimura. It's Shimura's reciprocity law that you use. And my student Alice G wrote a thesis on this. She's no longer in math, so maybe I shouldn't mention her name. It's for no good reason. She wrote a paper in 98. And and she's not the only one. There's more people that have been using these functions in various contexts. And even though it's only a partial solution to the problem, you only gain constant factors. It's something that speeds up things in practice quite a bit. And let me close that topic by mentioning a theorem, which is doesn't take a lot of space. Let me put it here. You can wonder how much better can you do by using higher level modular functions. So the factor 72 is only a constant factor, but in practice it's something you really notice and appreciate. And the theorem is very negative. It's a theorem that occurs in a recent paper of Renia Broker and myself. The factor that you gain, by which the coefficients get smaller, is universally bounded. The maximal, the factor gained in the size of coefficients of the class invariant polynomials, if I call them that, class invariant polynomials, is at most 800 over 7, which is something like 114.3. So you see that the 72 is pretty good. The theorem is in a way very deep. However, 99% of the proof is by someone else, by Dan Abramovich. It's related to the gonality of elliptic curves, since what you're looking for here is modular functions like the cube root of j that have the property that they somehow make things much smaller. And if you look at the corresponding modular curve, so if you have over the complex numbers the j invariant and your favorite modular function f of higher level, then there's a corresponding modular curve. If the level of f is n, it will be a quotient of xn, the modular curve, to xf. And this curve xf comes with two maps. There is the j function to p1, and there is f itself to p1. And what you would like to gain a big factor is that this is a big degree and this is a small degree. And What Abramovich proved is that maps of such modular curves to P1, they have a lower bound on their degree. Ideally, you would, for instance, have that f is of degree 1, and this is a very big one. That happens, for instance, for the Weber function. Since then, f is a rational expression of degree 72 in terms of j, meaning that you get a map of degree 1 and one of degree 72. That's great. But these bounds by Abramovich on ganality of elliptic curves imply they give a lower bound in terms of the corresponding subgroup, or if you want, the degree of this extension over cj. That's where the 800 over 7 comes from. And if you look at that theorem and you apply it in this situation, you deduce that the best you can do is a factor of 114. And probably the 72 is the best that you can get, since I don't know of any better example. So this is only a very partial solution, but it's something that works for practical purposes. You gain constant factors that can be pretty large. As for the second part, constructing the curves, elliptic curves with special properties, there's no need to point out that these have been used in crypto, but I won't be focusing on crypto today in any way. Oops. As you see, by reducing elliptic curves in characteristic zero modulo primes of the Hilbert class field, you can basically compute the order of the resulting elliptic curve. So that means that if you want the elliptic curve to have a given order n, for instance, you might want that n is a big prime number, since you want to do the discrete log on this elliptic curve, then the question is, if someone gives you n, can you easily come up with an elliptic curve over a metric quadratic field or a J invariant that reduces the right way mod p, where p is something that you can choose? That's another theorem. It's a theorem due to Renier Broeker. It's in his thesis that he completed last year in Leiden. On input n, on prime input n, I should say, you can compute a prime p and an elliptic curve e over that finite field with a number of points equal to n, equal to this big prime, in, I should say, heuristic time big O log n to the 3 plus epsilon. And it works by actually computing J invariants in characteristic zero and reducing them. And you see that the only way this can work, since the procedure I sketched here is exponential time in D. So basically this comes down to showing that you can use a very small D to obtain what you want. So the proof basically minimizes D that can be used. And if you do so, then of course you need to show that you can do it in an efficient way, and that the D that comes out is in fact fairly small. And roughly speaking, what you do, you look at this formula, and you see that actually it says that the number of points is the norm of 1 minus pi. So that means that you should be looking for metric quadratic orders in which your n is going to be a norm of some element. So what you do is that you try factor your n as nu bar in some ring of integers, ok. And you hope to be able to do that for a small k. And that is something that you can expect to be able to do, since solving such equations in metric quadratic rings can be done efficiently by an algorithm of Kornakia. And if you apply that, you can basically sort of list the discriminants that you start with -3, -4, and so on, until you hit the right one. And if you have such a nu, which is 1 minus pi, then you check, you hope that 1 minus nu, which is pi, has prime norm. And if it has, you're done. And the feature here is if the input is really prime, and then you get a guaranteed a proven prime P as output as well. So you can also generalize it for non-primes, then you need the factorization. These are all details. It's very efficient, so if you go to a talk by Rainier, he will produce your favorite elliptic curve, having your birthday or your favorite number as its number of points. Or even, since it's really very quick, you can have 10 to the power, whatever you like, your birthday. Okay, so just sketching the proof. So you see that in this case, there are two things that we're able to do. Namely, the explicit classful theory is intrinsically exponential. There's not much you can do, but you can sort of get along using smaller functions that make your life easier in practice, and that's something you use fairly often. And you need some some higher math, if you want, Shimura's math, to actually understand the Galois action here. And if you want to use it for curve construction, then you're not bothered too much by the fact that the process is pretty exponential, since you can use only small parameters. Okay, so that's somewhat like a positive note, and I would now like to go on for a little bit with the genus 2 case, where all these goals have not yet been achieved. So we go back, we replace 1 by 2 again, genus 2, and you write down a curve of genus 2. You have to select your model. So if you take the Legendre model, which is not called Legendre, it's called Rosenhain, the degree has to be 5 or 6. So if you take x and x minus 1 as zeros, you now get 3 parameters, say lambda, mu, and nu. That's the Rosenhain model. What changes is that you no longer parameterize the curve itself in a direct way. What you do is you parameterize its Jacobian. So in this case, what happens is that the curve C is embedded in its Jacobian, which is now an abelian surface, something two-dimensional, something algebraic. And that's the object you can parameterize using the complex numbers. So the map from the complex numbers now comes from C2. And as we've seen, all formulas in genus 2 are too ugly to write down explicitly, so I won't even try and do it, all these theta constants, to actually get equations for this Jacobian. But you do get a lattice, lambda, of rank 4 now, which is going to be the kernel here. So a Jacobian, if you want, has an analytic description in terms of complex numbers. And these are functions of two complex variables. And you can normalize this lambda in various ways. The standard way that people use is Z2 plus Z2 times this matrix omega, which is in the Ziegle upper half space. So rather than having tau, you get this matrix. And the whole problem, as you see also from the Rosenhain model, is three-dimensional in the sense that there's a three-parameter space. Three-parameter family. So the J function that we had for elliptic curves will get replaced by three functions. They have been defined by Igusa, so the isomorphism class over the complex numbers of these curves is determined by J invariants called Igusa invariants. And they're called J again, but there's three of them, so it's J1, J2, and J3. And they determine the isomorphism class. So the moduli space is three-dimensional. It's already more complicated than the genus 1 case. And also here, if you're given the J invariants, actually writing down the curve is already non-trivial. It uses ugly formulas that have been used by Mestre, I think. You have to intersect the cubic with a conic to get the 6 points that are, and then you transform it to 5 points if you want to get a Rosenhain model. So writing down the curve from the J invariants is already some work. You may need quadratic extensions, it's more complicated, but it can be done. And we have exactly the same two questions that we have in the genus 1 case, namely, what is it going to give us as far as explicit classful theory goes? And secondly, to which extent is all this useful in constructing curves of genus 2 with prescribed properties? Again, the CM elliptic curves mean that you need lattices having special properties, and the standard example here is that you take a field of degree 4, a CM field, so now K will be a CM field of degree 4, and you take your lambda equal to the ring of integers of that CM field. CM means that this degree 4 field is a totally complex extension of a real quadratic field, K0, real quadratic, so the field looks like this. And of course then there's some choice, so you have two steps, you have to choose a real quadratic field and then again a quadratic extension, and you can either make it Galois over the rationals, so it becomes either Galois or non-Galois. This is very generally true for anything you consider. In the Galois case, there's two cases. It can be either V4 or cyclic degree 4. In the non-Galois case, the normal closure will be dihedral, so it's a D4. So there's various examples you can have. And then for these fields, you have to view this OK as a lattice in C2. So that means that you have to select your embeddings of K in the complex numbers. In the imaginary quadratic case, it was only up to complex conjugation, which is fine. Here you really have to make a choice. You have to take two independent embeddings at the complex conjugation. That's called the CM type. And if you do so, then your OK is a lattice in C2, and you can look at the corresponding Jacobian and try and compute all the invariants. So what is this going to give us for explicit classical theory? And what is it going to give us for curve construction? In both cases, life is going to be more complicated. And in view of time, it's good that I don't have the answers yet. The classical theory itself, first of all, there is, depending on which case you have, the sort of generic case, of course, is the non-Galois case D4. Which has been mostly considered. V4 is somewhat degenerate, since then your Jacobian will be split, and C4 is maybe easy if you want to start doing actual computations in classical theory. And what you get, so the equivalent of the statement that the J invariant generates the Hilbert class field, already gets more involved. So in this D4 case, for instance, there is your K quadratic over K0. Over the rationals. And again, you can write down class polynomials. So there's now three class polynomials, H1, H2, and H3, for each of these three J invariants. And to write them down as polynomials having rational coefficients, you need to know the Galois conjugates of J1 of, in this case, OK. And you can actually describe the set of isomorphism classes in terms of K itself. So, roughly speaking, the class group of K will give a description of the various curves, the various lattices that give rise to the Galois conjugates. But it is clearly more complicated. It depends also a little bit on K0, so you don't get the class group of K itself that parameterizes the whole thing. It's the kernel of the strict class group to K0. Kernel. And then there are silly factors too, coming from sign conditions of units. Basically, this group sort of gives you the set of lattices you have to look at. And then these J invariants, they don't generate abelian unramified extension of K itself, but of the reflex field. So in this D4 extension L, there is the other, whatever K hat, called the reflex field. And if you start out with K, then these J invariants give rise to abelian extensions, unramified abelian extensions of K hat. So if you want to know something about K, you should start with K hat instead. It's symmetric. There's various problems. The polynomials you get, first of all, they have rational coefficients, but they're really rational in the sense that they needn't be integral. So that means that to recognize them from complex analytic information, you have to bound denominators. And that is something which hasn't been done in full generality. You can bound the primes that can occur, and then you still need to bound the exponents. That's work by Eyal Goren and Christine Lauder, which hasn't given rise to a final result. Of course, you can also hope that you know what the coefficients are and sort of continue, but then you don't have proofs, which may not be a problem if you're interested in curve construction, since in the end, the answer that you get justifies all the computations. But still, you may want to have theorems as well every now and then. So that's a practical problem. Then you don't get immediately the full Hilbert class field. You don't get polynomials that are necessarily irreducible. There's several classes, so there's much more details to be filled in. In the 2 minutes that I've left, I won't be able to do that. So basically the question is, how does this method compare to the general purpose method to generate class fields that you can do anyway? So explicit class theory, so the question here is, how efficient is CM here? In the complex quadratic case, it was really efficient compared to the standard methods that allow you to generate class fields of arbitrary number fields. Since class field theory, even though there is an unsolved Hilbert problem to do it in a canonical way, you can compute all the class fields. Just by looking at the proofs, you see that it boils down to creating certain Kummer extensions and sort of single out the extension you need. It's a very heavy method, since you need to adjoin roots of unity all the time. So if your class number happens to be 17, then you first adjoin the 17th root of unity, then you get a certain big Kummer extension. You use the Artin map in an explicit way. That's work of Klaus Fieker, who's done in Magma, I think. You can actually compute these fields, but you see that adjoining a 17th root of unity is pretty painful, since you have to work in such a big field. So that means that in general, if you compare it to the Kummer theory methods, they tend to be very slow if the class number is somewhat big, if it has big prime factors. However, this is also quite a heavy method, so you could wonder in which cases which method is preferable. And as far as I know, there haven't been very many experiments so far. Also, you can ask this question in the way, is there a runtime for anything? Well, right now, you cannot even prove anything about these rational coefficients, how bad the denominators can be. So bounding a runtime in an exact way is certainly going to be non-trivial either. So lots of open questions. Of course, as in the quadratic case, the thing is intrinsically exponential. The degrees will be large, and the coefficients, as is very visible from the examples that we do have, tend to be even bigger than in the complex quadratic case. So it's all pretty painful, and the question is, how efficient is the whole thing? And maybe these questions are just so dirty that you shouldn't even ask for the answer. Of course, there's also the open question, do there exist smaller generators? Nobody says that you have to choose these exponential functions to generate your class fields. The Kummer theory methods, in general, won't give you very large generators. So that's an advantage here. Yeah, in the case of the J function, you get a huge polynomial, but sometimes you can see right away what the Hilbert class field was already from the beginning. So then it's sort of overkill. It's way bigger than it should be. So here are many open questions. As for the curve construction, basically the question is, if you use CM, it is going to be exponential in all the discriminants. And if you say discriminant, in fact, there's two discriminants involved here. There's a real quadratic discriminant that you can choose. And in explicit computations, usually you take class number one field here. That makes life quite a bit easier. And then you have to choose a discriminant or relative discriminant of your extension. So there's two parameters you can fiddle around with. And if you stare at all the formulas that describe the order of the point group of either your curve or your Jacobian, it's not so clear that there is a small d or small set of d's of k0 and the extension that will give rise to the curves you need. So the analog of the Broecker result in the genus 2 case is something that still needs to be found, but it's certainly a nice and challenging problem. Yeah, I think my time's up. So thank you for your attention. Everybody needs coffee.
The fact that the H1, H2, H3 are rational coefficients and not integral coefficients, vary the denominator. Is it kind of intrinsic, or is there a hope to find better environments that could be integral?
That's again one of the open questions I didn't manage to ask. You could hope that replacing your this huge J invariants by the higher level equivalents, you get smaller polynomials. So for J invariants, there are at least a few theorems that the primes dividing the denominator are bounded by something. So, I mean, already for these polynomials, I don't know that whether there's very many theorems about primes dividing whatever. There's the Grossack J for the J function itself. Doing it for other functions is, well, Grossack J is quite a lot of work. For these functions, it's even more painful. So, real theorems, yeah.
So, but is it the proof that there are some primes in the denominator is closely related to this choice of J functions, or is it some kind of general?
If I understand Kristin Lauder correctly, she thinks it's intrinsic and depends on properties of the moduli space. Yeah, so maybe it isn't easy to improve your life here.
Okay, thanks.